Oh yay. Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has three causes on its oral submission docket. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. The State of Texas versus the Honorable Joe D. Clayton, Judge, an original mandamus proceeding. Crown Central Petroleum Corporation and Crown Central Pipeline Company versus the Honorable Carolyn Garcia, Judge, an original mandamus proceeding. In Caterpillar Incorporated and BD Holt Company versus Cipriano Shears and others from Cameron County. In each of these causes, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioner or relator may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by so advising the marshal of our court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument and will conclude all of these arguments before our noon lunch break. These arguments are being recorded by the clerk for the court's convenience, and if you desire, you may purchase a tape of an argument for a nominal cost from the clerk's office. We are now ready to hear argument from relator in State of Texas versus Honorable Clayton.
May I please report, Mr. Stephen Nelson will present argument for
the before you get started, Judge Clayton is no longer serving.
That is correct.
Will the people, are we going to substitute in another?
That is fine, Your Honor. Matter? We can substitute in. When I looked at the law on that, it seemed that since this was in Judge Clayton's official capacity, that the new judge who was sitting would automatically substitute in. May it please the court. My name is Steve Snelson. I'm the Assistant Attorney General representing the relator in this case, the State of Texas. This is a case of first impression arising under Chapter 110 of the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code. Under Chapter 110, the only form of appellate relief allowed in the State of Texas is by mandamus. Chapter 110 is basically a medical malpractice indemnification statute which requires the state to indemnify certain health care providers for acts of medical malpractice. This case frames two issues before the court. First, what is the limitation of the state's liability for indemnification under that chapter? And secondly, can that limitation ever be waived? The state's position that under Chapter 110.004, the state's liability for indemnification is limited to $100,000 or $25,000 for a single occurrence, regardless of the number of defendants who may be sued in that occurrence, and regardless of the number of claims that may arise out of that occurrence, and that this limitation cannot be waived by the statute. This is basically
in support of your position. You recite in your brief that the testimony before the Senate subcommittee on this issue was to the effect that medical malpractice claims settle for amounts of less than $25,000 for regular cases and $100,000 for emergency care obstetrical cases. I was unclear. Is that per doctor or is that per occurrence? So if you sue both a doctor and the hospital, the aggregate of what they paid in settlement was $25,000, $100,000, or was that for each health care provider that settled, they pay less than $25,000 or less than $100,000?
Well, Your Honor, my understanding of that situation, and also based upon PMLP, was that the claim of malpractice was settled for less than $100,000 limitation. I do not know if it was clear in the record whether or not they were including various claims which may be brought against various doctors or in aggregate, but that is basically what was decided in the state of the legislative history, was that the claims were settled for less than $100,000.
So we're not clear if the claim was personal as to a particular health care provider or a claim talking about as to the injured person.
I do not believe the legislative history on that point is clear. You're right, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
Basically, the state's position is this is a case of statutory interpretation. When we read Chapter 110.004, the language of the statute is clear and unambiguous. The state's liability in this situation is limited at either $100,000 for a single occurrence in the case of basically emergency or obstetrical care, or $25,000 for a single occurrence in the case of any other eligible medical malpractice claim. Now, the state's position is the limitations of the statute are clear and expressed. That is the limitation that all the state can be liable for in Chapter 110 as far as indemnifying people who may be sued arising out of these occurrences.
Mr. Snelson, would you agree that if we do adopt your position with respect to the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code, that we likewise ought to construe the Texas Insurance Code consistently, such that premiums would no longer be based on a deduction or indemnification of $100,000 or $25,000 per doctor, but would take into account the fact that that was a limit for claim?
Yes, Your Honor, I would agree that if Chapter 110 is interpreted in the manner which we suggest, that Chapter 5.14-5 of the Insurance Code would also be dependent upon the interpretation of Chapter 110. However, I think the language in 5.14 already defers to the interpretation of Chapter 110. If you look at the way the statute in 5.14 is set up, the first part is referring to definitions, and it's all saying whatever is defined in Chapter 110 is the meanings we are going to use for 5.14. So I think the way the Insurance Code is already set up, it is already saying, however Chapter 110 is defined, the interpretation in 5.14 will be dependent upon that. So I think the way the statute was set up and the interrelations between Chapter 110 and under Section 5.14, that would already be allowed, and whatever definition is given in Chapter 110 as far as the limitations amount would automatically apply to 5.14-5.
What's your understanding of how 5.15-4 has been applied in the past in terms of calculating the premium discount?
Well, Your Honor, I think there was some discussion at the hearing in this case how that occurred. JUA attempted to introduce an affidavit stating that they felt that the 5.14 required them to do a premium discount on a per-physician basis. TMLP introduced no evidence as to how they felt the premium discount would be required to be made. But under 5.14-5, under the third section, there is not a specific amount of premium discount which is required to be given by the insurance carriers. Basically, the insurance carriers have discretion. They basically will look at their situation, their statistical information, set their premium discount, and therefore justify that to the Texas Department of Insurance. So the statute does not require them to give a set specific amount of discount. Therefore, they would be allowed to take into consideration what indemnification is allowed under Chapter 110 and use that in adjusting their premium discounts. The first method...
Have they been doing that?
Your Honor, I don't believe there's any evidence in the hearing in this case how that was done. As I stated, JUA did attempt to introduce an affidavit stating how their preferred way of setting up their premium discount would be. TMLP did not give any evidence as to how they did it, so I think this court would be looking at what the statute requires and what the statute states. Since the insurance code does not state any set amount and leave the discretion up to the insurance carrier to set their premium discount, I think that they have a lot of leeway in how that can be set up in accordance with the insurance code.
Mr. Snelson, the insurers argue that the interpretation put on this by the Attorney General nearly assures that every malpractice case for which there's an indemnity coverage would have to go to trial. Their reason being that if you take the position that you just pay $100,000 to the injured party, that there's no way that the health care providers could ever allocate how that goes to their particular benefit without actually going to trial and determining how much the injury was worth. How do you respond to that?
Well, Your Honor, the state wouldn't agree with that because I think the fairest way to allocate what would happen would be exactly what was attempted in this case. After the medical malpractice case was settled, a hearing was held in front of Joe Clayton and was stated, Your Honor, we have $100,000 for the indemnification for this single occurrence. Both insurance carriers are here. We would ask the court to divide that amount of money between the insurance carriers. Basically, the district court judge who heard the case, who had the case in front of him, even though it didn't go to trial, could make a decision on how best to allocate that indemnification money. Both insurance carriers were present at that hearing. Neither one introduced any evidence as to how the money should be allocated.
Both doesn't that presuppose that the entire claim gets settled at that one time?
Well, no, Your Honor. In this case, this, what happened was settlements were reached at different times. The state waited until the case was entirely settled and then asked the judge to make a ruling as to how to divide the indemnification provision. The money which was there, that all the possible claimants for that money were in this case.
So you agree with the insurers that until the total amount of the injured party's claim has been determined, there is no way that there can be an operation of this allocation?
Well, Your Honor, that would be the fairest way of allocating the money. I think under the statute, since the state may be required in certain situations to be the payor of first resort, there can be a requirement that the state would pay the first $100,000 or $25,000 for the occurrence. That
and
not
then they'd be reimbursed by the Attorney General, I mean by the state.
Well, generally the way it worked in this case, Your Honor, was both insurance carriers made their payments and were seeking reimbursement from the state. So that is what occurred in this case. The state wasn't requested to be payor of first resort, so the issue of whether or not how the money could have been allocated if that request was made isn't in this case.
But you agree that until there is a final determination as to the total amount that the injured person is due, there is no way to allocate $100,000?
I would agree that there's no fair way to allocate the money that could be for the court to do that. Basically, in this situation, what occurs is the state has a certain requirement to pay the indemnification money. The insurance carriers, therefore, have a certain requirement to give premium discounts under their statute. Now, the question here is how much would the state be required to pay for this process? The state's position is that if you do not limit it to the express language of the statute of $100,000 per single occurrence or $25,000, there would really be no limitation in the statute. Because, therefore, every time a doctor made a claim, the state would be required to make a new payment. And I think the clearest way of expressing how there could be no limitation would be an example of if you had a medical malpractice claim where a person received $25,000 with damages for injuries to themselves, they sued four separate doctors.
That was the example in your brief, but it seems to me you also have a right to object to the reasonableness of any settlement. So why wouldn't that take care of that situation?
Well, Your Honor, if this statute were interpreted on a per-physician basis, and we knew that the patient who had received the act of malpractice had received $25,000 worth of damages, and each doctor had allocated $25,000 worth of indemnification, we could not object that the reasonableness of the settlement, because each doctor could claim he caused the $25,000 worth of damages to the individual patient. We would have a situation where we had clearly $25,000 worth of damages to a patient, and four doctors all saying that they would like to pay or settle for $25,000 for that damage. If the statute were interpreted on a per-physician basis, the state would not have a position, a situation to object unless we were able to file a joint objection on all four doctors, bring them all in the case and say, we have $25,000 worth of damages. The state is going to pay $25,000 in indemnification. Who should get credit for it? You would be in the same situation because then you would have an argument between four healthcare providers as to who would get credit for that payment.
I don't think you responded to Justice Spector's question regarding the state's right to object to the original case.
Well, Justice Gammons, under Chapter 110.006, the state can object in two situations. One, if the settlement of medical malpractice claim is substantially less than what it should have been settled for or could have been settled for, or any other facts or circumstances which would relieve the state of its necessity to indemnify those physicians. Now, I think there would be a different situation when you could have a situation where all doctors may qualify for indemnification. They all fit what is required to be eligible for indemnification, but that does not necessarily allow the state to object on those two grounds that we are going to deny indemnification. And
physicians pay individual premiums for individual policies. In this case, you have two separate physicians who pay separate premiums for individual policies, separate companies, separate underwriters. Both of them qualified by performing more, or a minimum of 10% of their practice for charitable patients. This special provision was set up by the legislature. The insurers are required to write coverage for these people. If the underwriters cannot receive indemnification on each of these individual policies, is that going to affect premium rates? And isn't this what the legislature intended to address in this legislation?
Your Honor, I believe what the legislature intended to affect by this legislation was to encourage doctors to practice charitable health care and to do the 10% which you just stated. Now, as an indirect incentive, what was stated was if the insurance carriers give a discount to these doctors, they will have incentive to do this type of work. I think there's a difference between the amount of incentive which is allowed under the statute and the fact that the incentive is there. Under the state's interpretation, the incentive to practice charitable health care in counties is still present in the statute. It may be to a lesser extent than what the respondents would like in this case as far as interpreting on a per-physician basis, but there would still be the same legislative intent for doctors to practice charitable health care in counties.
Mr. Nelson, before you sit down, would you please address the waiver issue?
Yes, Your Honor. In this situation, the real respondents have said that the state waived the limitation of the Act. It's the position of the state that under the structure of Chapter 110, since the state is not automatically required to file an objection, the state really cannot waive that limitation amount. The two requirements in which the state would be required to file an objection would be, one, if we were objecting to the reason of the settlement, or two, any other facts or circumstances which would deny liability. The limitation in the Act is a question of law, not a matter of fact which would vary from court to court. So therefore, if the state reads the Act as saying $100,000 is the limit of liability, that cannot be waived because that is expressed by the legislature.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Michael Eady and Mr. Ken Good present argument for the respondents.
May it please the court. My name is Mike Eady, and I represent Texas Medical Liability Trust. I'll be presenting argument on behalf of the real parties in interest, along with Mr. Ken Good, who represents the JUA. We will split our time 10 minutes apiece, and during my 10 minutes, I will address the language of the statute and the legislative history. And during his 10 minutes, Mr. Good will address the provisions of the Texas Insurance Code. The question here is, what is the proper interpretation of this section of Chapter 110 of the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code? The question is, real appropriately phrased in the terms of whether or not state indemnification of healthcare professionals will be on a per-case basis or whether or not it will be on a per-physician basis. And those are the terms that we use that just really boil down the issue. The first place to look, of course, is the statutory language itself and the exact wording. And here it is. It says $100,000 for a single occurrence in the case of an eligible medical malpractice claim. Claim is singular and indicates that it is also singular. This indicates that it's made to be applied on a per-physician basis. And this was the first thing right out of the box that Judge Clayton recognized, that is singular. And if you flip over one page in the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, you will find that there's a definition of eligible health care liability claim. And that definition was actually a modification of the prior definition, which was an eligible medical malpractice claim. If you look at Appendix A of TMLT's brief, you will find a copy of Senate Bill 1410.
And flipping through 1410, you will notice that Senate Bill 1410 made a modification and changed eligible medical malpractice claim to eligible health care liability claim in all sections except this one, which looks more like an oversight than anything else. But the definition of an eligible medical malpractice claim was a claim against a health care professional who devotes 10% or more of his patient encounters, that is his practice, to providing charity care and services. That's providing care to the doctors who participate in the programs that the state has set up, maternal health programs.
Mr. Eady, let me ask you.
Well, that's exactly what I thought. If you asked the same question, I'd like to know if you have any information.
No, go ahead.
Answer the inspector's question first.
Well, the question I wanted answered is the one that Justine asked earlier, whether the legislative history reflects that most claims are under $100,000, and does that refer to an entire case or a single health care provider?
I admit that I did not read it the night before. My recollection is the context is a claim. It is not the context of a lawsuit. It's not that a lawsuit is settled for $25,000 or less. It is a claim against a particular physician is settled for $25,000 less in most cases. And the legislative history in this case is very interesting because this was a very radical compromise position that was suggested at the very last minute. And you'll find not a whole lot talking about this particular provision other than just very brief comments during the last month of the legislation.
Steve, another question in that regard. If this provision was a part of an insuring agreement that an association of doctors had to cover their association, and all the doctors of that association were participating in the birth that was going on here, could you argue under the language of this provision that each doctor that had been sued as part of that association for their activities would each have $100,000 coverage as opposed to all three doctors being covered by the same $100,000 coverage?
Yes. If each of those doctors devotes 10% of their patient encounters, 10% of their practice to treating indigent of Texas under these programs, they should get full indemnity, and full indemnity means the maximum amount of available indemnity under Chapter 110 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code. And that situation has arisen, and there's a case going on right now in the Austin Court of Appeals where you had that situation. You had three doctors, and each of the doctors traded off on weekends, and each of the doctors saw the same patient. Each of the doctors had a claim made against them. And each of the doctors then sought indemnity in the full amount available under Chapter 110, seeking indemnity for $25,000 each for a total of $75,000. So that case does exist, and I believe that if you look at the legislative history and the purpose behind this legislation was to encourage these doctors to do this work. That's the incentive. If you're giving someone an incentive, your incentive should be clear to them. And that means that you should be able to sit down across the table from them and tell them, if you're a healthcare professional, you're a licensed doctor in this state, if there is an eligible medical malpractice claim made against you, that is, that you, a claim made against you and you doing the 10% necessary work, the state will step in if you're sued during one of those years, and they will put up first money of either $25,000 or $100,000. And that's not limited to other people in the same case having eligible medical malpractice claims as well. It's not diluted.
The incentive is a reduced premium.
Because
the bulk of the cases come in under these limitations.
That's right.
And if reimbursement is not made, to indemnity is not made to these underwriters for those amounts, the premiums go up and the incentive disappears, does it not?
That's exactly right. It works in a full circle. It also can snowball the other way. If the money comes in, then the claims experience history can be reported back being very good, and then you would expect that the premium discount goes up or premiums go down, and then the incentive increases for the doctors to participate in the program, which is, of course, what Representative McKinney wanted in the first place. So it does, everything is tied in that loop together in that regard.
The state has pointed out that in other parts of the Tort Claims Act, specifically Section 101.203, there's some language on limitation, and it's pretty specific, and it uses the phrase for each single occurrence. It makes it pretty clear that the dollar limitation for single occurrence is for a single occurrence, not a per claimant. How do you square this language with that language?
The Attorney General has a responsibility in administering part of Chapter 110, and it's not surprising that the Attorney General, the first place they would look would be the Tort Claims Act. But that's the worst thing to do, because those two statutes, Chapter 110 and the Tort Claims Act, are completely different. The Tort Claims Act is set up to just waive sovereign immunity in very limited circumstances. Very limited. It's more like this. It's protect the state. Under Chapter 110, where we have allocated state monies, and if you look at Section 106, there is a presumption that the money, that the indemnity is owed unless the state objects. You have a whole statutory scheme geared to payment of money. And just like I mentioned a second ago, it's a snowball effect. You pay the money, the good claims, experience history, we're going to encourage the doctor to do the work. It is a completely different background than the Tort Claims Act. So that's the first answer. That's the wrong place to look. The second answer is the language of the statute itself, because the key language here is an eligible medical malpractice claim. You could have several occurrences, and for each occurrence, you're going to be, if it is an eligible medical malpractice claim, you should be entitled to the full amount of the available indemnity. But clearly, you have to read it all together. So you take out the word single occurrence and ignore the rest of it, and then search, essentially do a Westlaw search to find where single occurrence appears, is not the proper way to go about doing any type of a statutory construction question, and that's what's done here.
On the other hand, if you take out for single occurrence, you've got the same argument, only better.
Only better. That's true.
So why put a single occurrence in there?
A single occurrence just to, again, make clear that
you don't need it any clearer than it is by taking it out. Your position is as clear as it can possibly be. Sticking it in there doesn't help clarify that. It helps muddy it up. So why would they stick it up in there if they didn't mean something else?
I do not have an idea of why they did that.
Really, your position amounts to parenthesizing or ellipsing the four single occurrence language. I mean, you read it to mean nothing more or less than the case of an eligible medical malpractice claim.
That's true. That's true. And we believe that that's consistent with the legislative history behind the statute. I'd add as a last note, the important things on a statutory construction question important here are to be true to what Representative McKinney wanted to do with the legislation, and secondly, for every interpretation, examine the consequences of that interpretation and the problems it creates thereby. And with that, we'd ask that this court adopt the construction that indemnification is owed on a per position basis.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. My name is Ken Good, and I represent JUA and Dr. Goss. Now, separate and apart from the legislative history analysis, which we've already discussed, my clients maintain that this statute cannot be properly construed without referring to Article 5.15-3 of the Texas Insurance Code. Now, the reason why we make this argument is because these two statutes are companion statutes. They were enacted at the same time by the Texas legislature. In fact, they were Section 17 and 18 of the Enabling Act. And as this court is aware, when the legislature enacts companion statutes, both statutes are deemed to be enacted with the same legislative intent. So the program, these two statutes make up a program in the state of Texas. And that program is to encourage doctors to perform charitable care in rural areas. The incentive to those doctors to perform that was to give them a premium discount. Section 3 of the insurance code gives directions or instructions to these insurance companies on how that premium discount is to be calculated. The instructions that are given is that the premium discount is to be calculated based upon the assumption that the state will pay the first $25,000 or $100,000 of any settlement or judgment. That is the interpretation which was followed by JUA in this case.
So that this is supposed to be a wash for the insurance?
Yes, Your Honor. It's not. JUA maintains that this statute was not intended to benefit them or to punish them. It was meant as a wash. Another way of saying it is JUA is not insuring the first $100,000 of an obstetrical or emergency room case. They're working it up, but the state's insuring that claim.
So your client has no economic interest in the outcome of this case?
We maintain that we do not. Now, we've had to go through the expense of working up the case and also the expense of fighting with the state on whether that indemnification applies on a per case or a per eligible physician basis.
But you're just kind of here pro bono publico.
No, Your Honor. We're here to try to recover the money back from the state because we didn't insure this risk. We shouldn't be...
You calculated it wrong to start with, but if you done it, if you do it the way you're... However this case comes out, if you calculate the premium that way, then this should be a wash for the company.
Yes, Your Honor. That's correct. And the reason why is that the insurance code statute says that we will give a discount which will reflect the reduction in the insurer's liability exposure on the indemnification of the first $125,000 of an eligible medical malpractice claim against a health care professional.
A physician comes in and buys $1 million policy.
Yes, Your Honor.
Dedicates 10% of all his practice to charitable work. And when you factor up the premium that's due on that $1 million policy, and he's eligible for this discount, you factor that in for the first $100,000, which is monumentally the largest part of the premium, because the vast majority of claims come in $100,000 or less, or $25,000 or less, depending on the type of case. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. In this case, so, Dr. Goff received over a 50% discount on his premium because over 50% of his patient encounters were encounters that would be eligible for $100,000 indemnification.
So that $1 million policy cost him substantially less because his first $100,000 or $25,000 is covered by the indemnity clauses.
Yes, Your Honor.
If it doesn't pay off according to this statute, then he's going to lose the benefit of that bargain and the incentive to do the charitable practice.
Yes, Your Honor.
Vaporizes.
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Good, your client's argument, the insurance company's argument, seems to be that with respect to this position, it should be a wash on the discount versus what gets covered. But wouldn't the legislature be more concerned about the industry issue rather than a particular advance? In other words, if the legislature was attempting to deal with this, why couldn't they have said, we're going to try and reduce every malpractice claim damage award by $100,000? And then we're going to tell the individual insurance companies with respect to their dealing with the medical community at large to factor in this reduction in awards by $100,000. And the insurance company do that. Why couldn't the insurance company actually do that? Why couldn't that be the legislature's intent and still produce what it's trying to do, which is a discount for physicians to provide pro bono?
Your Honor, we filed the affidavit of Mr. Chilton, who's the general manager of JUA, before the trial court. And he states in his affidavit that the insurance companies, at the point of calculating the premium discount, entering into the contract, they cannot calculate or determine in the future how many physicians are going to be sued in a particular case. So that if we apply the premium discount on a per case basis, it's impossible to compute that premium discount in any type of accurate fashion.
How is this different than the way insurance companies calculate their premiums for a segment of the market that either has greater exposure or less exposure?
Your Honor, they calculate their policies based upon perceived risks. And what JUA is saying is they cannot perceive what the potential risk will be when they are having to anticipate at the time they're writing the policy how many physicians may or may not be sued in a potential case into the future. they can't perceive an accurate a risk of how many physicians will be sued, because if you're going to separate on a per capita basis, depending on how many physicians are sued, and then how many of those physicians applied for a premium discount, there's too many factors to consider for calculating a perceived risk. JUA's interpretation of this statute was submitted to the insurance board. The insurance board approved a JUA discount to Dr. Goss, as they have to do with any action which JUA takes. And under the insurance code, under the Code Construction Act, which was filed in the supplemental brief for the state, one of the factors that this court should consider in determining the legislative intent is any action taken by the administrative agency. The administrative agency, the insurance board, has concluded that this statute, the premium discount, should be written based upon the assumption that the indemnification is going to be given on a per physician basis. As a result, when we get to the indemnification statute, JUA maintains that we should apply the indemnification on a per physician basis as well.
If a claim is settled for $300,000, indemnification still only exists for the first $100,000, isn't that correct? The underwriter is still liable for the balance.
That's right, Your Honor.
The state still has the right prerogative to object when any claim is filed.
Yes, Your Honor.
The reasonableness of that claim.
Yes, Your Honor.
Even if the claim was in excess of the $100,000,
because
the state would be indemnifying that first $100,000.
And that was originally done in this case as to Dr. Goss. The state filed an objection as to the reasonableness of the settlement, but they eventually withdrew that objection and agreed that the settlement was reasonable. So as this court is looking at the various interpretations which have been given or which have been argued today, we believe that the court should adopt the interpretation which best puts into effect the legislative intent. And we believe that intent was not to benefit or punish insurance companies. It was to encourage health care providers to provide indigent care. We believe if you adopt that this statute applies on a per-case basis, in effect you're punishing insurance companies because you're making them pay for a risk they did not insure.
But I thought you said this would be a wash.
I'm saying if you adopt the state's argument on a per case basis, though, based upon Mr. Chilton's affidavit that they cannot compute a premium discount based upon how many physicians may be sued in the future, that would not be a launch.
But do you agree with Mr. Eady's statement that if the statutory provision was a part of an insuring agreement the insurance company had for an association of doctors, and all of those doctors were sued, do you agree that the coverage is $100,000, assuming it's obstetrical services, that the association has $300,000 coverage or $100,000 coverage?
No, Your Honor, I do not agree with Mr. Eady in that regard, and let me tell you why. I know I'm out of time. We believe that the key in this case is the premium discount, and it's the policy. Now, a clinic can apply for a policy, and each physician in that clinic can apply for a policy.
So in other words, if there's one discount, then there's one coverage. If there's multiple discounts because of anticipated multiple coverages.
You really put your finger on the big problem in the statute, because it was written very poorly. The statute does not say that at the very beginning that to come under this program you have to apply for a discount. It just says if you want indemnity, all you have to do is provide indigent care, and then you can seek liability or indemnification from the state. So that's the problem. There are physicians who did not seek a premium discount who are seeking indemnification from the state. We do not believe, JUA does not believe, that that was the intent of the legislature, because if you say that, then you're saying that this statute was written to benefit the insurance companies, because then they're insuring a risk in some cases where they're even getting their money back from the state. We do not believe that's a problem.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. We would ask that the writ not be granted. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Carol.
May it please the court. The realtor would like to also point out two other statutes which are state indemnification programs cited in our brief. One is 104 in the Civil Practice Remedies Code, and the second one is in the Education Code in Section 59.08. Both of those are indemnification programs which require the state to make certain indemnification payments. Both of those statutes are constructed on a per-person and per-occurrence basis to make it clear that the state's liability in those statutes is predicated on either per-person and, secondly, capped per-occurrence.
So your position is if there were a single occurrence, three doctors were sued, and one of them was an eligible claim, and the other two were not, you would only owe for the eligible claim, not the whole $100,000.
That is correct, Your Honor.
In that case, the for a single occurrence doesn't really mean anything. It means limited to the claim.
Yes, Your Honor. It would be limited to whatever claims were available under that statute.
So you're saying per claim or per occurrence, whichever is less.
No, Your Honor, I think we are limited automatically, as you stated, to persons who are participating in the program and claims which are made in conformity with this program.
It just says in the case of an eligible claim, but your position is if there's one claim and that's eligible and two that aren't, you only owe for the eligible claim not to exceed $100,000.
Yes, Your Honor. The second point we would like to make is far as the incentives in the program. Now, as Justice Gamage, as you pointed out, if you had a situation where a person had $300,000 worth of damages and sued one doctor, the state may be required to make the first $100,000 indemnification, and the insurance carrier would pay the extra $200,000 to settle the total claim. If the scenario were reversed and you had $300,000 worth of damages to a patient and three physicians were sued for $100,000 apiece, what incentive do the insurance carriers have not to pay the $100,000? Because if it is on a per-physician basis, it's a wash. They have no financial incentive not to pay, go ahead and pay the first $100,000 because that's the state's money. They save defense costs. The resettlement is reasonable because $300,000 worth of damage to the settlement person. The state would therefore actually underwrite all the damages in this case, and there would be no cap because then the more physicians you sue, the more indemnification money which the state would be required to pay, and the easier it would be to settle those claims. The insurance carrier would have no excess money to pay. That would be the incentive. The insurance carrier's incentive is to say, we will settle for whatever the state's payment is. We save defense costs, we lose no money, but we still get our insurance premiums.
Let me ask you this question. In Section 110.005, provision about giving notice to the Attorney General. One of the prerequisites before anybody can make a claim under this is that the doctor or the clinic has to have in place a policy of insurance with a minimum amount of $100,000 per occurrence. Don't you think that that weighs in favor of the claimants here, that the $100,000 per claimant matches up with the $100,000 per occurrence in Section 110?
Well, Your Honor, the right way I read 105, or it has $100,000 and $300,000. So you have $100,000 per person and $300,000 per occurrence. So actually, if you look at the per occurrence and the cap in that situation, that makes sense in conformity with that the per occurrence in 104 is per occurrence. Because it was understood that there may be some extra pay or additional payments which may be required to be made by the insurance carriers. That is what they're getting the premiums for, and I think that actually is informing the state's position.
But they're required to furnish $100,000 per physician or per clinic, yet the indemnity that you say they get is substantially less than that. Is that correct?
Well, the indemnity, depending upon how many doctors are sued, can be a lesser amount than the actual $100,000 or $25,000.
But you would agree that the statute requires more than that indemnity to be provided under the insurance policy, or more coverage than that to be provided?
Yes, Your Honor. There is more coverage which is required. The statute does require the insurance carrier to provide, or the person to have a certain amount of insurance coverage in excess to what would be under the indemnification agreement.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first cause, and the court will now take a brief recess.